Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness.
This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say so what?
It's a
police
joke.
In riot gear with truncheons. I am ashamed to call myself a
the
European.
The recognition of Guaido, unelected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, so I would reprimand you over that.
Well, here we are on the eve of Christmas, Nolig Sunday Eve, etc. Yes, in Strasbourg, in the pit for a Christmas special.
Are you the MC now?
I think I am. So no one else is talking. I feel I have to.
Bethany and Oisin have a job. And we have two MCs today.
Yeah, I know they're both starstruck.
This is Oisin's first venture. And listen, he is from Cork. We were looking for an interpreter to bring along as well, but we couldn't find one. So I hope he's understanding him anyway.
How's it going? So I'm clear to everyone.
A modest start. He's restraining himself now, you see.
He learnt how's it going from me.
Yeah.
How's it going by?
Aru from Cork. I am Aru. Do it, Spuds. Do.
Okay. Right. So here we are in the basement in Strasbourg, week and a half before Christmas. What's happening, Micheál?
Oh, Jesus. How much time have you got?
Well, about 40 minutes if you behave yourself.
Well, I heard you were in trouble anyway, if it started off.
Oh, that wasn't me now, that was Mick. Yeah, a bit of a, we got an old reprimand, Micheál.
What do you mean, Mick, and you at you?
Okay, we both got a reprimand. Two of six MEPs scolded. Reprimand. I've never been reprimanded before. Anyway, what does it mean?
Not before time that you were reprimanded.
Are you embarrassed is the question.
I must be an embarrassment to the nation, you know.
Anyway, our reprimand, this was a punishment. We're coping pretty well under it by the president who reprimanded us, which means he's just said we're very bold. Nothing else other than that we're very bold because on one of the days we refused to show our COVID pass on entering the parliament. Now, we made the point that we replied to his original letter saying that we did this as part of, if you like, a gesture of, democracy in the European Union, that we're appointed by the people and that only the people can keep us out of that building. We proved that point and won that point on the day. But it was also kind of a gesture of solidarity with all of the people in workplaces all over, including the European Parliament, who feel that it's a violation of their fundamental rights that they have to show a health card in order to get access to their job. And I mean, I think President Sassoli said we got the lowest reprimand out of the six because we were very polite to the staff, very mannerly. We confessed to our sins and only did it once. So we're happy that the point was made.
Yeah, because with the initial accusation, it was kind of insinuating more or less that we were a threat to the staff, we were a threat to the security of the place by not following the rule. And we told him, listen, you go back and talk to the staff on the day that were on duty when we tried to enter the building without showing our COVID pass, despite the fact that we are vaccinated and we've actually been vaccinated three times at this stage. He says, you'll find that the staff will confirm that we were 100% respectful at all times and under no circumstances were we a threat to anybody. Our argument was accepted and unlike some of the others, we weren't fined either.
Well, it's funny because you don't need to show your pass if you're working anywhere else in Belgium. It's just in the parliament you have to show to go to work.
Yeah, and people might remember that when we had the vote on this famous green pass, it must be about a year ago now, there was 40 MEPs on which we were, two of us, were part of that 40. We voted against it on the grounds that the potential for it to be used in a discriminatory fashion were high and that we didn't think it was a good idea. They were adamant that under no circumstances Would people be obliged? Would it become obligatory? Or would it be used in any way to target any individuals who did or didn't want to partake in the measures that were being put forward? But that's exactly what's happened. I mean, literally, right now, it's just about impossible to live in Europe without the vaccine if you want to function in any kind of a public job or in a lot of even private jobs or to move around the place. It's become very, very difficult. They're making it compulsory.
I think the sort of disconnected and incoherent response across member states is a problem for the Commission as well, because I think tomorrow Italy are joining Ireland and Portugal in requiring a negative PCR or antigen test as well as a vaccination, which is just incredible. A step further again. But yeah, I mean, look at it's mayhem. Like originally this was supposed to be either or, now it's everything, like, you know, it's just
And I mean, mad. We were told that vaccination would cure everything, and now we have to get tests as well.
Well, it's the irony again, as we pointed out, and even as the World Health Organization have pointed out, the problem is not the small numbers of unvaccinated in Europe who can't or won't get a vaccine. It's the huge chunks of the world that are denied access to it. Like, so here we have that irony continuing still as well. So,
yeah, I mean, the numbers, they reckon still that the numbers in Africa who've got the two vaccines is around 2%. And it's around 5% for those that have got one vaccine. And then when a new variant arrives from South Africa, we're, oh, my God. They seem to forget that 27 member states of the European Union sat around some big tables in Brussels not so long ago and decided not to release the wherewithal to actually make the vaccine themselves. They wouldn't lift the patent. They wouldn't share the knowledge because they decided that they would protect big pharma's profits instead. And now we're getting new variants from the very place, Africa, where they refuse to share the vaccine knowledge. Mm. I mean, you couldn't make it up.
And I saw that Alexei Navalny's daughter was in the plenary today to accept the illustrious Sakharov Prize from the European Parliament. But I didn't see you in the plenary clapping. Were you there?
I'm right there, yeah. I tell you what, they wouldn't have enjoyed my contribution on the day if I had gone, right? I mean, what a joke. I mean, oh, Jesus.
Well, I mean, look, there's a couple of jokes about it. Like, I mean, the first of all is that there is, well, the previous pedigree of award winners of this, you know, misnamed prize for freedom of expression. You know, if the European Parliament was serious about defending freedom of expression, the award would go to Julian Assange this time, no question. But I mean, Navalny is a peripheral figure in some ways in Russia. He has been adopted by the European Union establishment because he's viewed as an opponent of Putin, but he is lauded as sort of some sort of a liberal democrat when actually he's kind of an ultra-nationalist racist, really. And the idea that such an individual, a bit of a thug, really would be awarded a prize for freedom of expression and free speech is a bit sickening. But he's in good company with the other previous winners, so...
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's only won the prize because he's anti-Putin, and that wins you a lot of votes in this place at the moment. I mean, it's absolutely sick. And it was only last week that we had two High Court judges in London deciding that, oh, it was safe now to send the same Julian Assange to answer charges of espionage, overruling a lower court judge, barrister from... last February, I think it was, where she deemed that despite the fact that she wouldn't accept the argument that Assange was only in prison and was only being charged because he had told the truth and exposed US war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also obviously NATO war crimes that were involved as well. But she had deemed that the US prisons were so bad that his likelihood of committing suicide would be greatly enhanced if he was put in prison in America. So she didn't allow the extradition, but these two High Court judges decided otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very much the point that we've made, that this was a political decision. I mean, we were present in the court earlier in the month, and it was very clear to us on the basis of the legal arguments that the US prosecution had very little armour in their their war chest was pretty empty, and the defence kind of won the arguments, but that the judges came back with the decision against Assange so quickly kind of shows this is sort of a political decision. And we've always made the point that politically putting pressure on Biden will be the key in this case. But it's a bitter blow. I mean, the evidence came out that Assange had suffered a mini stroke in October when we were there during the cold case. He certainly didn't look well. But it was funny, I was there yesterday at a webinar hosted by a university in Russia, where we were discussing the Assange case and freedom of expression. And it was really interesting to get an insight into young people in Russia, because we're talking about, a key part of the European continent where people are demonised and vilified, and people kind of think that everyone in Russia goes around with horns or whatever. The only thing, and one of the threads in the conversation was about how there's no understanding in the West anymore about Russian history. They just hear words like Putin and Navalny, but they don't know all the nuances and the differences in culture, in history, or any of these things. And Europe is moving into a dangerous place. We discussed the Assange case, the irony in that, the double standards regarding Russia, how it's portrayed in the Western media, how that doesn't reflect reality. And the young people were having their say in that. They couldn't really understand why Russia was demonised. And it is because of, I think, the military-industrial complex, vested geopolitical interest, but it's not in the interests of the citizens of Europe. And that's mostly manifested itself in getting into a really scary place now regarding relations between Russia and Ukraine, with the EU whipping up things. And I know you got to speak on that one, Mick, which was great this week. A little bit of reason in another sea of European Parliament madness.
Yeah, I mean, if you were listening to the debate, 95% of the people in there were saying, oh, everything is Russia's fault, and all the problems in the Ukraine are Russia's fault, and it has nothing to do with the fact that the US and EU helped orchestrate a coup in 2014, which an awful lot of these problems have come from. But back in, I think it was 2018, Zelensky got elected. He's the president, and he got a powerful vote, and but his mandate was to end the war in the Donbass region, and he had promised that he'd work with Russia. And now people mightn't realise it, but there's an arrangement called the Minsk II, right, which was a conference held in Minsk, which is in Belarus, in 2015. And there was an agreement there, and they set a pathway to achieve a lasting peace, right? And this solution was agreed by the Americans, the UN, France, Germany, Ukraine and Russia. And it was going to give autonomy for a demilitarized Donbass within Ukraine, but it was going to be guaranteed by international treaty. But in actual fact, right, it isn't the Russians who have stalled on this. But the Americans and the EU don't seem to like the idea of Minsk II now, because they think that they can give a bigger blow to the Russians and reduce their influence even more in that section in Ukraine. But the joint motion that was put before the parliament this week, it laid the blame for the lack of progress on Minsk totally at the feet of Russia. And there's actually no rational argument for it. They can't stand over it, right? And, I mean, what's really gone on is that Zelensky has kind of lost control a bit, and these far-right-wing militias, they're Nazi, some of them are Nazi groups, and they've been armed by the West, right? The Americans and the Europeans have helped to arm far-right-wing militias that are involved in the trouble in Donbass. And unfortunately, these guys are getting all kinds of weaponry and from the West and making things a lot worse. And they're, instead of getting closer to peace, we're getting closer to an outright war. And the truth is, if they want peace in Ukraine, and people forget, Ukraine has an awful lot of problems among Ukrainians themselves. Forget about the Americans, forget about the Europeans, forget about the Russians. The Ukrainians have an awful lot of problems themselves. They don't really know what kind of a state they even want themselves. They broke away from the Soviet Union in 1991 and they haven't really found their feet since. Millions have left the place. Mm. Millions to find a better life elsewhere in the world, mostly obviously in Europe, some in Asia. But there's been an incredible, I think there's about over 7 million people have left, which is an amazing figure. But if they want peace in the Ukraine, if they want to avoid war, any solution will have to involve actually having a rational, sensible discussion with the Russians.
Well, I think the European Union are playing a really dangerous game in terms of arming the Ukrainians, in terms of ratcheting up the rhetoric. I mean, nobody wants war in that area. I think that's totally true. They would say that Russia are being the aggressor, but there's actually no evidence to support that at all. I mean, any troop movements by Russia are actually more a defensive warning against the idea of the expansion of NATO to their borders, which was a commitment given to them at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, that there wouldn't be an extension of NATO that far. But that's actually what's happening, and they are aggravating, the Europeans are aggravating, NATO is aggravating the situation. And the ones sort of slobbering with glee and delighted with themselves are, of course, the people selling the arms in the first place, because it won't be their sons and daughters who are coming home in body bags if something does blow off there. And we are certainly, while it's not maybe the most likely, we are nearer to a conflict than we have been at any time previously on this scale for many years now. It's incredibly dangerous, and the role being played by the EU is incredibly unhelpful.
Yeah. What was the mood like in the plenary when this debate went on with Borrell?
Well, unfortunately, Borrell hasn't been good on anyway, but Borrell is very, very weak. He was a very poor choice for the High Representative for Foreign Affairs for the European Union. He doesn't carry any weight. But look, a lot of this trouble would have started in 2008 when there was a big conference, I think it was held in Budapest. And it was what they said at that time was that they were going to try and bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And, of course, that set off alarm bells. Russia now could do without having NATO on its border. And anyone that thinks that that's OK, well, it's not really how it works. And when the Soviet Union was dissolved in 1991 by Gorbachev, along with, in conjunction with the Europeans and Americans, it was agreed that NATO wouldn't expand further eastwards. But that agreement has been broken several times. And what we're seeing now is a huge increase in NATO's presence in Eastern Europe. We're seeing more and more pressure coming on to spend more and more money on defence to increase NATO's position in Eastern Europe. And it's all about promoting the arms industry, using Russia as the big bad bear. And this isn't a sensible path to go down, and it's not what the people of Europe want either.
I mean, it'd be a bit like the, say, the Chinese doing a deal with the Canadian government to, you know, assemble mass weaponry on the United States border. Like, you can imagine how they'd react. And yet we hear, oh my God, these Russians are the aggressor. But that's actually the comparison. What they're doing to Russia, it would be something akin to that. So, yeah.
Well, it was a bit like at the so-called Indo-Pacific resolution last week at the Foreign Affairs, where they're giving out about China being very aggressive in the South China Sea. But the Americans have more warships in the South China Sea than the Chinese have, right? And it isn't the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah. It's actually
South China Sea.
It's actually the South China Sea.
I know, madness.
And what was this that you were talking about with Cuba as well during the week?
Oh, groan. I mean, oh, it's just so upsetting now. And I know the Cuban embassies all over the world went into free fall that, again, we have another motion before the European Parliament plenary giving out and condemning Cuba, which is utterly disproportionate and ridiculous. I mean, basically what we have is sort of far-right individuals in the US who have been consciously out to undermine Cuba since its inception, really, since they got rid of their, they paved an independent path for themselves. But the US have a blockade on. There is a far right elements here in the parliament who link in with ultra conservative forces in the United States to delegitimize rational decisions, really, by the Cuban government, who are under siege by the US in terms of the blockade, violating their human rights and so on. So what we have, again, before the plenary is a motion condemning and calling for the release of a number of so-called political prisoners. But these are really American agents, violent thugs in many ways, which any government would have the right to imprison. But this is what they do. They basically make a sort of a human rights victim out of these agent provocateurs and violent thugs, and then say, oh, yeah, this is the regime in Cuba is undermining them. But actually, the Cuban government has shown nothing but restraint. If we'd any criticism, it would be that they bend the knee too far, really, in terms of being conciliatory. But here we have another motion before the House out to condemn and undermine them, you know.
But well, it's very, it's imagine, it's given that we had a resolution on Nicaragua this week as well. It's actually kind of similar because I got speaking time on Nicaragua as well, and they were all getting up one by one to call for the release of political prisoners, right? Political prisoners, my nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, these were guys involved in a US-backed coup in 2018. They killed people, some of these people. More of them were involved in criminal financial activity. They ended up in jail. And the biggest criticism of the Nicaraguan government in Nicaragua when I went out there for the elections was that they spent so long looking into the activities of these fellas before eventually putting them in prison. And it looked like then that they were actually being put in prison just before the election. But in actual fact, they should have been in prison 18 months before it. And they weren't. They were put in the last year they were, right? So not all of them, but some of them were. So what happened was then, so you had these violent thugs financed by different, by USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, US, two arms of US regime change. And these thugs were eventually arrested, eventually tried and put in prison. And they said, oh, we want to run for election. Oh, so now, oh, they're political prisoners now. And so we have MEPs queuing up to call for the release of political prisoners in Nicaragua. Oh, this is terrible. This is terrible.
And I mean, I think the motion in Cuba was really insulting. Like, it didn't in any way condemn the blockade, even though this is a violation of human rights of the Cuban people. It's an act really of economic warfare. I mean, some of the statistics given, the extra sanctions that have been put on Cuba, who've still managed to vaccinate 90% of their people. But Donald Trump added another 243 sanctions against Cuba, including things like closing off access to Western Union and so on. So Cuban families who have family members living abroad, they can't send foreign currency and all of that. And it hinders the country's access to vital medicine and so on. And that these, you know, Biden's administration have obviously continued this as well. So no mention of any of these difficulties and yet targeting their internal discussion. I mean, it's a disgusting cabal of ultra right wing sort of hangers on here in the European Parliament. They really have no credibility on these matters. But it is sickening to see it again. Yeah. What a waste of time when there are serious human rights abuses, real ones taking place.
Well, I mean, to emphasise how mad the Cuban resolution is, even the right wing Josep Borrell is actually on the Cuban side on this one.
Yeah.
And there is a EU-Cuba political dialogue and cooperation agreement, which the EU is standing over, and they're refusing to lift it. And what these far-right fellas in the parliament now are trying to do is to undermine that, and they want to stop it. And seemingly, this week, when the resolution was being argued out between the different groups to see what sort of a compromise resolution they could come up with, it was so irrational between the groups that they could, there wasn't any possibility for any form of negotiation or compromise. When the far right, as you said, Claire, refused to even acknowledge the fact that the US blockade and the US illegal sanctions for 62 years were having such an impact on the country of Cuba. They were calling on the Cuban government to do more for their citizens, but they're calling on more and more sanctions to make it more difficult for the same government to look after the same citizens. Mm. I mean, it really does bring the European Union into disrepute to see this happening here.
Yeah, again.
I guess it'd be interesting to see how the vote goes on that one. It might not even pass.
Yeah, it'd be tight enough, yeah. Yeah, but obviously...
I mean, I think the S&Ds and the Greens pulled out as well, didn't they? They said it was too much for them.
It was just too bad for them.
Yeah,
they're pretty right-wing on foreign affairs matters, but it was even too bad for them.
Yeah.
So they'll vote against it, they will.
Yeah.
But EPP and you'll find a lot of Renew...
so bad.
Yeah, Renew are terrible. But Renew are probably more right-wing than EPP on foreign affairs. I'd say that the far right crowd will win this one.
Yeah.
Really?
I do.
God. Oh. Anyway. Yeah.
We'll see. That vote is tomorrow, isn't it?
Tomorrow, I think.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is there any? Oh, sorry. Yeah, go on.
And another news, Claire. You recently did a meeting with the Irish Justice Department. Apparently, there's some new reforms for the Gardaí. Should we be worried?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, you know, it's kind of interesting that both of us made a submission to the Justice Committee. We had been on the Justice Committee for many years in our days in the Dáil, and obviously we'd made a bit of a name for ourselves on Garda issues. So when we saw that the government were putting forward a proposal on new powers for the Gardaí, well, we were obviously reminded of Spider-Man, like, with great power comes great responsibility and all of that. So we were a bit worried about the guards getting more powers without necessary democratic checks in place. Now, we made a presentation to the Justice Committee. They only wanted one of us to speak. So I, as I told them, won or lost the toss, depending on what way you might look at it. But I was the one who ended up with it anyway.
Couldn't keep her away from it.
Yeah. So, yeah, look, I mean, we shared the panel with the Policing Authority and the Data Protection Commission, and the Justice Department were there as well. I found it quite good. It was held remotely, so we weren't able to go into the Dáil, which was unfortunate. But on the good side, actually, most people agreed with the points that we were making. So we were making points about the concern of aspects in the legislation which undermine people's right to a lawyer when they were detained on spurious grounds, that a Garda could throw out a lawyer who was being disruptive, whatever that meant. That would completely undermine the right to a fair trial and would be actually unconstitutional. There were worrying aspects about stop and search. We argued for measures to be put in place because every police force in the world introduces a profiling of types of people, be it people of colour or from their ethnic background or from where they live, that there should be a record kept of who is stopped and searched. And actually, that was broadly supported across the board, which was great as well. What was also supported was one of our calls saying that the guards should not be allowed to issue warrants. So normally now it's only a judge who can issue a warrant, but they wanted to introduce this measure in an emergency that a senior Garda could issue a search warrant. Now, that will be absolutely a very, very serious step and a breach of confusion between the Gardaí and the judiciary. And actually, there's no circumstances which would provide for this, particularly now when the judges have got used to, you know, I mean, 15 years ago, the Law Society looked at this issue and didn't recommend that the guards would be given this power. Actually, they said if there was a technological solution, that might be better. Along comes COVID, the judges are used to dealing with technology and dealing with stuff remotely. They're used to getting up in the middle of the night. So turning on their computer, they'd be still able to have their pyjamas and their slippers on and grant the arrest warrant. There's no need to hand that power over to Gardaí. So we were quite pleased with the feedback from the TDs and senators, including the ones from the right-wing parties. But it'll be interesting, no doubt, the Department of Justice now will get in and try and undermine some of those arguments that have been made and dumb down on some of the protections. But it's a serious one we're talking about. Yeah, massively so enhanced powers for the guards.
What happens now at the next stage with the bill?
This was pre-legislative scrutiny, so public bodies and individuals can have an input, and then they put meat on the bones, as it were. But it means the Department of Justice, who kept a pretty low profile at the meeting, they'll kind of talk down a lot of the concerns people had, try and reassure people and reword it a bit, and then you'll get the actual legislation, and that will go into, begin the discussion on that, the debate at various stages in the Dáil. So it's a serious one to watch.
Yeah, listen, it can be very complex sometimes, and the danger is that you can give powers sometimes that are required in certain circumstances. But if you introduce the power, it can be used in unnecessary circumstances and the power can be abused. Now, I remember during our time looking into the malpractice in NAMA, and I had a number of meetings with private Gardaí who were trying to investigate NAMA at the time. We're getting reports of some terrible things going on, terrible malpractice, some of it outright corruption. But the Gardaí were struggling to get search warrants to get into NAMA where the evidence was. And NAMA, as people might remember, when Michael Noonan gave them permission to start shredding emails after 12 months, which was outrageous. But NAMA were busy trying to cover up their tracks, to cover up the bad behaviour. And meanwhile, the Gardaí were struggling to get into the place to actually investigate it properly. I mean, look at, unfortunately, the authorities that be, and I'm not blaming the guards for that one. I blame higher up. The government didn't actually want the truth from NAMA anyway. They made no effort to get the courts to be more cooperative with the guards in order to gain access into NAMA's inner workings for an Garda Síochána at the time. I felt at the time that the Gardaí were trying their best but were hampered.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I mean, you're right. We want an effective police force. It's not about that. And the legislation says it has that goal of having an effective police force, but also one that is compliant in terms of fundamental rights provisions. Because, as I said, when you do give people great power, it does come with responsibility. And simply restating sort of fundamental rights objectives isn't really good enough. One of the points that we made was that they might need to look at specific penalties for breaches. Like, it just says, oh no, you have to respect fundamental rights. Well, sure, that's already there anyway, and we know that there are a lot of abuses from the Gardaí. And then there does seem to be a very worrying clause at the end of the bill which would allow them, and it's in tandem with this very controversial case which from the Supreme Court allowed evidence collected unconstitutionally to be permitted. And that this legislation seems to be building on this, because at the end of it, while they've all these nice words about respect for human rights, they say, well, if you end up breaching fundamental rights, it doesn't affect the ability of the evidence collected to be introduced in court, which is just now complete and utter now two fingers. Because A, the judges are the only ones who decide what's admitted or not. So there's a confusion there. But it seems to be authorising illegal behaviour, basically.
That reminds me of I was listening to a lawyer on a podcast only the other day, and he was talking about the fact that the Americans were collecting information in a way that contravened their own constitution. They were waterboarding and torturing people in connection with the wars, in particular in Iraq and Afghanistan, but other places as well. And when Obama was running for election in 06, 07, 08, He was elected in November 08, came to power in January 09. But during his election campaign, he said that this is terrible and it should never have happened, and it shows how far we've sunk. And he says that anyone who behaved badly, anyone that was involved in torture at state level, would face the consequences. Mm. Once he was elected, and it was put to him again, and he says, look it, let's bygones be bygones. He says, let's look forward. Now, they didn't even stop the torture, which was very disappointing. But, I mean, Obama was probably one of the most disappointing presidents of all time in terms of what he promised and what he delivered. And that was just one of the earlier ones.
Well, look, it's the groupthink and lack of accountability. And it's what we found in our Garda work over the years, the failure. It didn't mean that every Garda was involved in abuses, but many of them ended up turning a blind eye. And when you look at some of the new powers proposed in the bill, and you add it to that background, it is worrying. Like, one of the things that they could stop and search people are, is there something, a hacking device, a potential hacking device that could be used to rob information, basically a computer. So everybody has a computer in the form of their phone. So they could say, no, this is a potential hacking device now. I'm pulling you in and I have the power to do that. Like, so that's a bit scary now for a lot of people when everybody has that kind of thing. And it's these provisions which, you know, everybody wants an effective police force, but excesses are there. They've happened everywhere else. And this is going, I think, a little bit of a step too far in some of these things. So look, we were very grateful to the Justice for Committee for inviting us in. Sorry we couldn't be there in person, but we will definitely be following this one as it goes on, for sure.
Nice. So I think we've got a country lined up for today, do we? Well, I'd actually suggested Cork, but apparently that was shut down pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's not a country, Oisín.
Well, not yet.
A disputed territory. We don't want it.
No, listen, I
their own language, no one can understand them.
I can understand the people of Cork wanting their own country.
Yeah,
they are different now, in fact.
Well, they are.
People's Republic of Cork.
A lot of other absolutely people would agree with it, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I have to say, I got wonderful support from the people of Cork during the election, and
it all comes back to parish pump.
No, listen, I love being in Cork. That's a great spot.
Yeah.
So do Cork people as well.
Okay, and that is linked to Spain.
It doesn't stop.
Hey, come here. They sell paella.
Hold on a minute now. He's on about the Cork people loving being in Cork. Well, he's not in Cork. He's happy enough to be in Brussels and Strasbourg. He's abandoned Cork. He left them for dry.
And I heard that he had a legal business, actually, that he could have inherited.
Lined up for him.
And a shop.
Yeah,
I know. It's absolutely.
There's a quick plug there. Well, no. Max Sweeney's quick pick crooks down if anyone's passing.
Max Sweeney's quick pick.
Best 99s in Cork.
Okay. Do a nice ham as well. Now, I'm a vegetarian, but I do believe that they cut a nice ham and corned beef too.
Well, it is possible that Oisín has gone out to sow his wild oats and make his fortune, and the shop and the legal business show is probably the pension at the end of it all, you know?
Maybe, yeah. Anyway, so, but on the subject of Spain, because we do like to pick on countries here, you know, there's no point in, you know,
being nice to everybody.
Be nice to everyone. It's not possible.
Well, some people would say, why don't you just be nice to someone?
Okay. Well, okay. So the Spaniards, a lot of them here, 10% of the European population, massive, 59 MEPs, loads of them, pretty much spread out against the groups. In fairness to them, they don't have any real Greens or anything like that, but they're represented in every other group. The only Greens they have are actually, they're not Greens at all, they're the separatist groups. So the Catalans, the Basques, the Galicians, all of these would be in the Green group, not because of the Green bit, because they're something else with those kind of autonomous regions or independent regions or whatever you want to call them. They have a big influence. Obviously, we would get on well with the Catalans. There's Catalans in the Green group. There's Catalans non-aligned. There's ultra-right-wingers in Vox who are just absolutely appalling. They are the most right-wing people I've seen. You know, people talk about alternative for Deutschland and the far right and all that. To me, the most consistent ultra-far right people in this plenary are what they call Vox.
There's a bit of a contest there now. I'd be reluctant to say which was the worst.
I think, I suppose, the biggest group where the Spaniards, and they are very influential, is the SNDs, the Socialists and Democrats, which are the second biggest group in the Parliament, and they're dominated by the Spaniards. So they have a leader who's a Spaniard. The leader of our Libe committee is a Spanish former minister. There's a number of former ministers in the EPP group as well. I've a number of them in trans. They're pretty visible across the board. They're represented in all the groups, and they're very much a mixed bag. We have three different lots of Spaniards in our group. We have the ones in Podemos, who kind of arose out of the anti-austerity movement. We have the United Left Communist Party of Spain, who are in government now with Podemos and with the Social Democrats. And then there's another fellow who was in Podemos and now isn't. Oh, and then there's Fernando the Basque as well. Yeah, a Basque. Basque separatists, lovely, yeah, they're really sound.
He's leaving soon though, isn't he?
They do a shared arrangement. They're very egalitarian there. The Basques and the Galicians stand on a joint platform. So there's a couple of them, they kind of go between, depending on who gets elected, between the left group and the green EFA group. So we have Fernando this year, and after 3.5 years, a Galician woman will come in, but she'll join the Green group.
Or 2.5, is it?
No, 3.5. He gets the bigger, I don't know, whatever way that is. Right. And again, there's somebody in the Green group like that. Like, there's a couple of Catalans in the Green group, and then there's the Catalans who are outside as well. They'd be quite influential. And of course, Mick's favourite commissioner, Borrell, is also.
Yeah, well, that reminds me of the fact that there's, of the SNDs, there's an awful lot of them on foreign affairs.
Javier Nart. Oh, he's Renew.
He is Renew, yeah, but he is Spanish, yeah. But a lot of the SNDs, a lot of SNDs went into foreign affairs. And, of course, they're from Borrell's party, as you said. And they more or less, it's like as if they have meetings with Borrell in advance of Borrell coming before committees or the plenary. And they kind of take Borrell's line on most things. So Borrell is pretty good, all things considered, on Cuba. So the S&Ds in Spain are pretty good on Cuba. Borrell is a horror scene on Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Ecuador. So are the S&Ds in Spain. And when there's ever a discussion on Latin America or South America, the Spaniards all want to talk about it. Yeah. It's because obviously they were most of them were colonies of Spain years ago, and they kind of feel as if it's still theirs or something. They think they have a divine right to pontificate on all matters, Latin America, Central America.
I think
America.
A number of countries, isn't it, like the likes of Venezuela and these, if your parents were, you know, started in Spain, you have a right to have a Spanish passport and that. So there are huge numbers of diaspora from the likes of Venezuela and these South American countries, probably, you know, Argentina, all these places, huge numbers. So they're quite influential in Spanish society, and some of them will be, you know, they'd have the voice of the ultra right wing, like, you know, Leopoldo López is a Spanish MEP for the EPP, father of Leopoldo López, the right wing thug in Venezuela. But then there's others in the EPP group, Zarza Lejos, a former justice minister in the EPP group, who's the rapporteur on file on Europol and the European arrest warrant. And although politically we'd have very great differences, I have to say he's a very capable and mannerly man. So it's a mixed bag, really, between them, you know.
And of course, Puigdemont as well is there, former.
Puigdemont is there, and we do get on. And Carla, Clara Pansetti and Tony Comín, they'd be the three non-aligns. And Diana Riga and Jordi Soleil would be the two Catalans who are in the Green group. They'd all be pro-Catalan independence. Mm-hmm. The Catalan independence issue is like a proverbial red rag to a bull in here. It's enough to incite the rest of them to go absolutely mental. It was one of the reasons behind the growth of the far right, and that as well was sort of suppression of Catalan independence. And I mean, our attitude on that is it's quite simply a matter of democratic rights. It's not up to us to decide the fate of that country. But what we do find is that there are substantial legacies of Franco's rule remaining. So Franco was a dictator up to the 70s. Spain is actually relatively new democracy. We talk about Eastern Europe and democracy and defence of democracy, but the control of the courts and the judiciary and the lack of proper rule of law and separation of powers there that we hear about them giving out about Poland and these countries, there are big questions to be asked in Spain, and we saw that with the treatment and the imprisonment of the Catalans.
Yeah, well, we went to see the Catalans imprisoned that time outside Barcelona. it became really obvious that the influence of Franco is incredibly strong within the judiciary in Spain still. And it's not an issue that the European Union touches on much. But just going back to the personnel, do you know your man, Urtasun? Urtasun? He's a type of green. Is he in the actual green? He's Spanish, right? And he's actually pretty good on foreign affairs.
Really?
And he signed our motion on Venezuela looking for the money to be released for Venezuelan children for medicine.
Really?
He did, yeah. No, he's pretty progressive and I like him.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look at our paths have crossed more with the Catalan. As usual, you get on well with Javier Narra, a former journalist who's in the Renew group.
I get on.
I don't know why he's in the Renew group, though.
I get on well with a whole lot of people whose politics I disagree with, but it doesn't stop me from talking to them and being sociable. I'm just kind of a social animal.
I know, but he's better than that as well. It's not just that you talk to him. He's not bad, like, on a good few stuff.
No, he's...
But he's independent thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's actually not with a party in Spain. He's just with Renew, but he's independent.
Well, yeah. Well, just for example,
Well, he is horrific on Venezuela.
Yeah.
Terrible, right? Whereas he's pretty good on the Sahel, right? And he actually worked down there for a good while. But he realises that the Sahel has become a total... quagmire, and that the Europeans are just wasting their money down there. They shouldn't be near the place. They're killing more people than they're saving. They're doing more harm than good, and they shouldn't be near the place. And so he's been pretty good on that, all right.
And we had some interesting facts about Spain, which I can't put my hand to now, but they were...
the world's largest producer of olive oil.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Well, okay, but I'm glad you said largest, because the best olive oil obviously comes from Italy.
And it's the second most spoken language.
Yeah.
First language, like, you know, mother tongue, second in the world. Spain is the world's second most spoken mother tongue. Yeah, I mean, it's... So,
Is there more people speaking Spanish than Chinese? Or Chinese first?
Chinese is first, yeah. Chinese.
Okay, so English is third, yeah?
Must be, yeah. And it's the second largest country by land size after France. And of course, we have the Canary Islands, and they actually have territories in North Africa as well. You know, they keep their little colonial history. They've dumbed it down a bit. You know, they've escaped a little bit out of the limelight for their colonial past, but it's alive and well there anyway.
Well, we couldn't talk about Spain without talking about football. And
I could.
Well, I couldn't. I mean, okay, well, they haven't won as many World Cups as Germany or Italy. They have been very good in the last 20 years in particular, but Spanish football has always been good. You had the wonderful Real Madrid side that won the first five European Cups. But I always remember one of my... I remember going to the World Cup in 86 in Mexico, and Spain, I think they were playing Denmark, but they won, they scored 6 goals, Spain did, and Butragueña scored 4 of them. An incredible feat in a World Cup match, and it was out in Neza, in the slums of Mexico City. Never forget it.
But you have to say that Spain side that won the World Cup is probably one of the best international sides ever. Like 2 European Championships, World Cup.
I'm not convinced about that. I mean, Spain won the World Cup in South Africa in 2010.
Yeah.
They won it scoring the least amount of goals ever in the history of the tournament in the process of winning that World Cup. Listen, they had a couple of incredible players. But they played in a very conservative way in many ways. They were very good at holding the ball.
Yeah.
Very frustrating for the opposition. They had a powerful midfield. Difficult to say they're the best ever now.
I suppose economically as well. I mean, they kind of shared a lot of the kickings around the time of the banking collapse, and that they were under the cosh as well, like ourselves. I think it's interesting when you look at the economy now. Statistics which says small and medium-sized businesses contribute to 70% of employment in Spain, which is an incredible figure.
Yeah.
And they've got a huge load of money now in the recent recovery plan as well, you know. But high unemployment still.
That's an interesting figure, but I think if you look at any of the Mediterranean countries, you'll get something similar. I'd say the figures for Italy are pretty close to that. Italy... And it was one of the reasons that Italy have never really felt at home in the European Union. The European Union is designed more for the big buys, for the big global projects and the people who bought into it more. Likewise, small and medium-sized business completely dominate in Italy. Mm. And most business in Italy is still family-run. Well, so obviously, yeah, with those figures there, the same must be true of Spain.
It is. But what is interesting about Spain, and it would be a bit different than Italy, is actually they're really big EU fans, yeah, love the EU, can't get enough of it. They're one of the people who really agree with the EU, who really agree with the euro, all this sort of stuff, probably egged on by tourism or whatever. But that would be, I think, a little bit different from Italy. I mean, they're the fourth biggest player in the EU. Their influence... Yeah, you definitely notice they're present. They're present in the big groups. They're there. They're vocal. They're one of the big players, even though they kind of always do second fiddle to France and Germany. They're very much up there, I think, you know.
But they're a long way off Germany and France.
They're a long way off.
I mean, Germany are in the Premier Division on their own.
Yeah,
and
no, that's true.
They run the place.
Yeah.
And France are in the next division. And you can start fighting over then who's in the next one. You can throw Spain, Holland... Austria, probably the Finns.
I wouldn't put Austria in there now.
In terms of economy, not in terms of influence in the parliament that we come across, but in terms of economy, the Dutch and the Austrians and the Finns, I'd say, are probably next in line after the Germans and the French financially.
Interesting. Well, I think we'll have to return to that in the new year because Christmas is approaching and so is the ending of our podcast. So what do you think?
Time for turkeys.
You've an update on turkeys, Mick, don't you, for the people of Ireland?
Well, I mean, I've been hearing that the turkey, you want to be wary of the turkey you're eating this
year. Hear,
hear. Now, well, Claire never really took a liking to turkeys.
Well, I love them. That's why I don't eat them. I don't eat my friends.
Ah, listen, hold on a minute now. What about those poor carrots?
Well, I like carrots as well.
Parsnips.
They're not sentient beings.
Hold on a minute now. They have feelings as well.
Well, they might have, but
listen, I have flowers in my apartment in Brussels and I talk to them.
Well, I know that.
I mean, if anyone ate them, I tell you what, they'd be trouble.
Who's going to water them when you're back in Ireland?
Yeah, and if somebody ate the brother or anybody, you'd be sorry. But yeah, you think it's okay to eat a turkey. So anyway, I don't. That's why I do like them.
But anyways, seemingly a lot of turkeys have been affected by the bird flu. A lot of turkeys have been put down. And seemingly, someone said to me about 2 weeks ago that most of the turkeys that survived the bird flu in Ireland needed some pretty unnatural help in doing so. So
a vegan Christmas will be had in Wellington Bridge then. Is that where we're heading?
Believe it or not, but the great... Noel O'Connor from Limerick has promised to organise...
The only butcher in Ireland who had his premises opened by two MEPs, one of whom was a vegetarian.
Yeah, well, he's promised to get me a free-range turkey reared out in the field. So I'll probably give that a try.
Not what you know, who you know. No doubt. For the rest of you who don't have connections with Noel O'Connor, we would recommend a vegan Christmas... with heavy on the vegetables, which would be very nice. Our favourite Christmas vegetable?
All the way from Brussels?
All the way from Brussels. Has to be.
Yeah, it can't be Brussels sprout.
It cannot be a Brussels sprout. Bethany, what's your favourite vegetable?
Cauliflower cheese.
What?
Cauliflower
and cheese. It's not really very Christmassy.
Come on now.
It's not a vegetable, but that's cheese.
It's killing the taste of a vegetable.
Yeah, that's cheap.
Yeah, it's not even a vegetable. That's cheap. Yeah.
Your favourite vegetable is cheese.
Yeah.
Listen, I told you the English know nothing about food.
I know.
They're a disaster,
yeah. Yeah, I know. Just Scots fry.
It's hard to believe they ruled the world one time, eh?
Yeah, indeed.
And now they're putting cheese on the cauliflower.
Indeed. Anyway, so it only leaves for us to say Bannockdean and Ullag, etc. Yeah.
Right. Well, listen. Yeah. The whole thing about Christmas is to enjoy it.
Exactly.
And as I always do, behave yourself. Good luck.
Right.
Good luck. Arrivederci.